Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I call the war for the free world. I can't think of anyone in the United States Congress at the moment who has really demonstrated greater clarity on the various dimensions of that war for the free world and been more industrious, shall we say, in trying to help the rest of us understand what this is about than our guest in this first segment. He is Congressman Louis Gohmert. He represents with great ability the people of the 1st Congressional District of Texas. He serves as the vice chair of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, and Homeland Security. He is in the Immigration Reform Caucus. Before coming to Congress, he was a district judge and chief justice of the 12th Court of Appeals in Texas, and he has served his country in uniform as well, rising to the rank of captain in the United States Army. Congressman Gohmert, it is the greatest of pleasure to have you back with us, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
At the moment in this war for the free world, we seem once again to be afflicted by a complete muddle, at least at the leadership level, about the nature of the enemy in the war.
You really think?
I do. Congressman, talk a little bit about how it could possibly be that all of these Islamists aren't having anything to do with Islam.
Why don't we start with the president's speech last week when he's hesitating to take action, not sure what he should do, but then he says, that means I will not hesitate to take action against ISIL. What do you mean? You've already hesitated. What are you talking about? And I think that all we have to do is go back to last year. Now we know that the president had ordered multiple arms shipments from the United States to what he calls the vetted, moderate Free Syrian Army. And then the Free Syrian Army, these devout friends of the president's, kept being suspiciously raided, and they kept having the weapons we were sending being confiscated by ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra. And finally, in December, the president had to order the weapon shipments to his buddies, the Free Syrian Army, because they kept being taken. And then for some inexplicable reason, in April, the president turned back on the weapons spigot to Free Syrian Army. Patrick Poole, our friend, has a great article about that from September 11th, appropriately dated. But anyway, it shows that he has hesitated. He doesn't know what he's doing. And there even, you know, Senator McCain out there saying, gee, well, if they had bombed a year ago, he did say to bomb a year ago, and Obama did say also he was going to bomb a year ago. But the truth is, Frank, if the president and all his minions and his bobbleheads that can only nod up and down, they can't go side to side, if they had all had their way, then Assad would have been bombed out of existence, and ISIS would have full control out of Syria, and with full control out of Syria, they'd be on their way taking over all of Iraq and probably threatening Turkey now.
And Jordan,
so, and then we have all those duplicitous allies of ours who shake our hands and say we're with the United States and yet send tremendous amounts of money to support terrorism. But unfortunately right now, Frank, the United States of America is rudderless. We are leaderless. And although we have been told we don't want some feckless, that was their word, agenda, that's exactly what
that's what we've got. You know, you might add to that list clueless, because I think what you've really just laid out, Congressman Louis Gohmert, is that we've got among the so-called allies who are now mustering out, we're told, to help defeat these non-Islamic Islamists of the Islamic State, a whole slew of nations and groups and so on that are actually deeply imbued with exactly this same ideology. They call it Sharia. And, you know, there's no way this can come out right. As far as I can tell, at the very best, we're neutralizing one set of Islamists for the benefit of other sets of Islamists. But this is very reminiscent, Congressman Gohmert, of what we were doing back in September 2012. Let's talk a little about that. There's a hearing coming up this week, as you know, of the Select Committee, the first. I'm a little nervous, I must say, about the kickoff hearing being a kind of review of the other team's eminent figures, namely the so-called Accountability Review Board and the whitewash that they did. Do you think this is likely to actually to shed light on what remains unknown and deeply problematic, notably the policies?
Well, you and I know a lot because of friends that will say in confidence what they don't feel they can afford to say publicly. But actually, before Benghazi, and you know this, you and I have both been talking about this for years, but the truth is, what this reflects is this administration's policy in Egypt when it basically cut Mubarak's throat, figuratively speaking, and even was supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood taking over Egypt. And after they took over, agreeing to send weapons and money, helping them all they could, as we now know, Morsi was weaponizing the Sinai, much to the danger of Israel. And then we did the same thing in Libya. I mean, the president, as we know now, had refused for 3 days to give Gaddafi an answer as to whether he would agree to let him leave peacefully so nobody had to die in Libya. But the president, just like he couldn't pull the trigger with the rescue of James Foley, just like he waited many months to go get Osama bin Laden, thank God that his inability to make decisions didn't keep us from being able to get bin Laden.
Well, it was overridden by his subordinates is what happened in that case, as best I can tell. But here in Benghazi, his inability to do anything.
What he did in Libya. Bingo. If he doesn't kill Gaddafi, I mean, let's face it, we bombed the caravan Gaddafi was trying to get out in, and that's how they were able to get him. And then the country is just a hotbed of problems. And because Libya fell, then Algeria and Tunisia fell, this president has all of that to his credit. As I've said for years now, well, ever since the so-called Arab Spring, this president helped jumpstart a new Ottoman Empire. And if not for the awesome Egyptians, the people that stood up, joined hands across religious bounds, and said, we don't want radical Islamists, that Ottoman Empire would be well on its way. Syria would have fallen to the radicals. Iraq would have already completely fallen. And thank goodness we still got a chance.
Congressman, before I let you go, we've just got to turn to one more topic. Again, you have been an incredibly important leader on the fight against amnesty that this president has been trying to engineer through executive action as well as legislatively. Talk a little bit, if you would, about where that stands now in the wake of this invasion of our southern border and all of the thrashing around. The president has kicked the can down the road, but amnesty deferred is still amnesty, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And actually, back in July, our Speaker Boehner was pushing. He had a great group of people, a working group, come up with principles, and then he had somebody secretly, we don't know who drafted it, I think I know, draft a bill supposedly based on the principles. And when I got it and read it, finished reading about 2 a.m. on the wee hours Wednesday morning before our vote on Thursday, it was clear to me, having put on my former judge and chief justice hat, this was a de facto amnesty. It would keep anybody from ever having to report for a hearing and be deported. And so we were able to wake up enough people that it wasn't going to pass. And then Thursday afternoon, because Numbers USA, Tea Party groups were calling their Congress members, Mark Levin and others were preaching about how bad it was reading specific provisions, we were able to stop that vote and actually just scrub completely the 18 most offensive pages and get together a really decent bill that we passed very, very late that Friday night. It gives me hope. You know, people are waking up.
And
but I know there were people that said, What difference will it make whether we pass our bill in the House or not? Go ahead and vote for it, because the Senate won't take it up. Frank, I'm telling you, if we had passed that, Reid would have been crazy not to take it up and pass it. So we did a good thing in July. That gives me the encouragement for the future.
Probably he would have made it even worse. But there was an example, Congressman Louie Gohmert, of the difference one man makes. And I know you weren't alone in the end, but your leadership was critically important. We can't be adequately grateful for it or help call enough attention to it, but we're going to continue to try. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Congressman Louie Gohmert of the 1st Congressional District of Texas, one great American. Thank you, sir, for your service. Keep it up. Next up, Louis Fleischman on Hezbollah, south of our border.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist, or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there. America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by my colleague and friend, Luis Fleischman. He is a senior advisor to the extraordinarily important Mengus Hemispheric Security Project at the Center for Security Policy. He is editor of its America's Report. Luis also is an adjunct professor at Florida Atlantic University, the author of a terrific book, Latin America in the Post-Chavez Age, The Security Threat to the United States. Dr. Fleischman, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Frank, once again in this wonderful program that you've been running now for a good number of years.
Thank you. It's good to have you with us, as always. Luis, let me start with a matter that you have been tracking closely. We were discussing with Congressman Louie Gohmert in the previous segment the problems with our open border and the degree to which the Obama administration is actually exacerbating the security, among other implications of that dangerous situation, by extending amnesty to people here and thereby creating kind of a magnet for more to come. Among those who are coming across the border, it appears, in some numbers, as you have been tracking at the America's Report, is a gaggle of very bad actors, whether it's Hezbollah or the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps or other Islamists, some in partnership with drug traffickers and so on. Talk a little bit, if you would, about what's that entailing at the moment, Luis, and the relationship between these various bad actors and the government of Venezuela.
Well, no question. First of all, the government of Venezuela has expressed open hostility to the United States, which is not simply rhetoric. It's also acting on the ground. We all know that the government of Venezuela has cooperated with every possible actor that can do harm to the United States or that declared the hostility to the United States. And that includes drug traffickers. For instance, Venezuela today provides the main ports and airports to all the drug trafficking that goes from Colombia or South America through to the United States. Venezuela has also cooperated with Iran, and of course there are several cells of Hezbollah that are protected by the government of Venezuela.
Luis Fleischman is our guest. He is the editor of the America's Report, a project of the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project at the Center for Security Policy. And Luis, you were making this connection between the rabidly hostile government of Venezuela when it comes to the United States and its allies and interests, and drug traffickers and Islamist terrorist groups and so on. What is the government of Venezuela doing that we know of specifically to enable the danger that these characters represent to us here as well as in the rest of the hemisphere?
Well, two things. One is there have been testimonies that Revolutionary Guards are already cooperating with the Venezuelan government.
That would be the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Iranian Revolutionary Guards, and of course, that would serve two purposes. One is the asymmetric war that the Venezuelan government has embraced, which means war, terrorist war against the enemy. I mean, theoretically, is the United States in case of an American invasion, but in practice could be actually using those terrorists to advance the revolutionary goals. Secondly, of course, Hezbollah, which is part of Iran, it's an Iran proxy, has also a presence in Venezuela. And what the Venezuelan government has done is also providing passports to individuals in the Middle East. And that includes not only members of Hezbollah, but also members of Saddam Hussein's government, like, for instance, the Ministry of Interior, Tariq Assami, is known to be the son of the person that represented the Ba'ath Party of Saddam Hussein in Venezuela. Now, as you know, ISIS is composed, among other things, among many other terrorists and other negative elements, to say the least, also by former soldiers of Saddam Hussein and members of the security apparatus. So that means that the fact that, let's say, Iran, Hezbollah are fighting on opposite sides to ISIS, that doesn't mean that ISIS cannot take advantage of you know, that relation with the Venezuelan government, because the Venezuelan government would provide passports or would facilitate the activity of anybody who is hostile to the United States. Yeah.
And Luis, we have evidence from our friends at Judicial Watch that this organization, the Islamic State, or ISIS, if you will, has actually been operating a little closer to our border than Venezuela, notably in the city of Juarez in Mexico, just across the river from El Paso. And there are suggestions that they may well be lashing up with these drug trafficking cartels and thereby creating a tremendously serious threat here in the United States as well. I'm very concerned about this and share, I think, the sense that you at the Mengus Hemisphere Security Project have that if we don't secure our border and resist these developments in Latin America, this will metastasize to our great peril. And Luis, in that regard, talk a little bit, if you would, about the apparent bid for a seat on the UN Security Council by Venezuela's government, the post-Chavez government, to be sure, as you talk about in your book, Latin America in the Post-Chavez Age. But nonetheless, one deeply imbued with all of the anti-Americanism and revolutionary fervor and so on. The United States, the last time around, as I understand it, fought that bid tooth and tong. Do you see any evidence that the Obama administration is doing so in this current round?
Well, let me answer to the two parts of your question. The first is, with respect to the Judicial Watch report, yes, I think this is a very serious issue that the United States needs to take very, very seriously. And it's not only a matter of securing our borders, it's also a matter of making sure that the state of anarchy that prevails in Central America and south of our border is properly addressed. That's an issue that we have not addressed properly in terms of our environment. With regard to Venezuela's bid for a seat in the United Nations Security Council, there is no, at this point, I have no evidence that the Obama administration is opposing it in the same way that the Bush administration successfully opposed it in 2006. I think this is an opportunity to send a message to our listeners, particularly in the U.S. Congress, that they should call attention on the Obama administration and make sure that the Obama administration opposes the inclusion or the appoint or providing a seat in the Security Council to Venezuela.
I couldn't agree more. And if we don't, they will be a thorn in our side at every turn in this in these coming difficulties, whether it's with respect to Russia and Ukraine or whether it's respect to the Middle East more generally or heaven knows anything in our hemisphere. Luis, let me close with very quickly. We've got about a minute left. Your thoughts on the rise of anti-Semitism for sure, but anti-Israel sentiment in our hemisphere.
Well, there is an anti-Israel sentiment in the atmosphere, in the hemisphere. I would say that in political terms, the number one responsible for that anti-Israeli shift is Brazil. Brazil expects to be also, they want a seat as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. And they know they can do it with the support of the third world countries, the so-called non-alienated countries.
Particularly the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC.
That is exactly correct. And as a result of that, they have taken an actively pro-Palestinian position, which means also anti-Israel position, even though they deny it. But they definitely are the leaders on that, and they were followed by a number of countries, including Chile, including Uruguay, and others.
Well, this is another reason for us to hope that we will see a change of government in Brazil in the very near future, but we'll be coming back to you for more analysis on that. Luis, we have to go, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Luis Fleischman, Senior Advisor to the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project and editor of its really important America's Report. Thank you, Luis. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, a decorated Navy SEAL turned cyber warrior talks about the threat from the Islamic State and what we can do about it in the cyber domain. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. After a British citizen was beheaded by the Islamic State on Saturday, UK Prime Minister David Cameron insisted that Islam is a religion of peace. President Obama made a similarly false claim last week, contending that the Islamic State is not Islamic. Such statements are problematic for three reasons. First, they demonstrate complete ignorance of the jihadist nature of Islam as practiced not by extremists, but by its authorities. Second, downplaying this threat misleads Western populations about the growing danger posed by those like the Islamic State, determined to impose globally through jihad the form of totalitarianism they call Sharia. And third, when our leaders lie about Sharia, that ideology's adherents perceive them as submitting to it, which only further emboldens our enemies. It's time for the truth about Islam's Sharia. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to be joined by John Idonisi. He is an extraordinary, multifaceted warrior in this war for the free world. Today, he is associated with a group called the White Canvas Group that specializes in cultivating alternative and disruptive strategies on behalf of our national security. He comes to it by virtue of being a Navy SEAL, a decorated background in service to our country in uniform, now serving in other capacities, including helping to improve the performance of the Counterterrorism Center. He is an adjunct faculty member at San Diego State University. He's in the process of getting his PhD in computer science and cyber techniques. A man of many parts, in short, and we're delighted to have him with us. Welcome, John. Thank you so much for taking some time with us to talk about, among other things, the challenge that we're facing in this cyber domain in terms of both understanding the nature of the enemy we're facing and waging war against them. Glad to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank, and thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. It is certainly disruptive times, to say the least. I mean, here we are as a nation trying to figure out who's in charge of what when it comes to cyber, and then we have an enemy, public enemy number one, or number one and two, if you will, with ISIS, who are leveraging the ubiquity of an internet connection to wage war. It's really interesting times.
Talk a little bit about that, because I think most of us are still getting our heads around who the Islamic State is. I believe they are simply the latest manifestation of the global jihad, but they're obviously pretty adept, both at combat on the ground and in the cyber domain. And how are they taking advantage of the latter to help what they're doing on the former?
Right. So what we see, and it's a lot of public information's out there, and all this information is really out there. It's just a question of how you view information and connect the dots. And these groups rely on the internet for a myriad of things beyond just planning operations. But most importantly, I would say recruitment, funding, and to spread terror. I mean, showing the pictures of beheaded people furthers their cause, both from a financial recruitment and from a reputation standpoint. So they're using these sophisticated mechanisms, which really, I'll go back, the mechanisms aren't sophisticated. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, the way they're employed in terms of a concise narrative that crosses domain, cultures, and demographics is in itself a complex issue, and they're doing it quite well.
Yeah. Talk, if you would, a little bit with me about something that is a little puzzling, I must say. Clearly, the beheadings on camera of Americans and now a Brit have rocketed to prominence, this group, and galvanized attention around the world about them, presumably to the benefit of the group in terms of drawing recruits, drawing resources, drawing fame. They claim to be the caliphate, and, you know, this is evidence that they are about the business of trying, as the, you know, Sharia doctrine dictates, to impose it and bring about a global rule of this caliphate, John. But it also seems to be galvanizing the opposition to them and is likely to bring down a world of hurt on them. How do you see the cyber warfare piece of this, or the information operation piece of this, netting out?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say that first, let's rewind the tapes and go back to when Zarqawi was showing Nick Berg's execution. What you saw after that was senior al-Qaeda leadership said, hey, not so fast, because what in effect was happening is they were barbarizing their activities. So what was viewed as an ideological is now more in the realms of pure evil and horrific across any lexicon of religion, ideology, or civilization. And so here we are with ISIS unthrottling, showing these types of pictures out, but they're broadcasting to an audience, i.e. the world, that is not in 1400 AD. And this type of behavior in the name of whatever is not an acceptable, I mean, it's just not tolerated. And what they're actually doing is they're starting to drive a significant amount of wedge room between Arab nations in general. And what we are going to need is the Arab nations are going to have to step up, both publicly and behind the scenes, in order to counter this. And so, yeah, I think that as these videos come out, what they're actually doing is they're galvanizing their adversaries just as much as they're galvanizing their own.
Our guest is John Idonisi. He is a decorated Navy SEAL, now retired and working with the White Canvas Group. Just drill down on that for a moment with me, John, because you've had a lot of experience with these characters, including notably in combat operations in Iraqi Freedom. I'm wondering whether there's that much difference, really, between the Islamic State and its beheadings and other efforts to rally people to their team and wage jihad against infidels and apostates, as they call them, among the Muslim world and so on. And, well, the Saudis, for example, and certainly al-Qaeda and the Taliban and Boko Haram and, you know, al-Shabaab and on and on and on. Is this really simply the latest and perhaps most powerful of these jihadist organizations, but actually one that is joined at the hip, both in terms of its ambitions and its techniques, with the rest of the global jihad?
Yes, I would say yes, and for this reason. It is what ISIS has been able to do is sort of materialize the confluence of several different factors. One, savvy media folks that can do all their social media postings, etc. Two, savvy cyber computer programmers that can give them equipment and operations, and three, the ideological horsepower that is driving all these other groups. And they've been able to blend all those together into a focused effort.
I think this is something that's just beginning to sort of come to light, that there is something about the proclamation of a caliphate within this doctrine and practice of Sharia that is qualitatively different from what went before, namely that it is now legitimate under, you know, Sharia to engage in what is called offensive jihad, as opposed to what was previously possible without the caliphate, which was just supposedly defensive in character. The difference is probably lost on most of us, but apparently it matters a lot in terms of the legitimacy of the activity within this jihadist community and that supports it. Are you seeing this, and how important is it for us to understand that and to use information operations and the various social media techniques to try to counter that?
Number one, it's extremely important because, as you said, this is a proactive group, not a reactive group. And they actually, in many ways, I think, make the traditional al-Qaeda leadership, Zawahiri's left, as a stale and tired, out-of-date group, right? These people are going faster, further, more violent. They're driving far, far further than any other previous organization that has established this. Al-Qaeda did want to establish the caliphate. They did. However, this group seems to be, at all costs, moving closer to that. The problem is the platform by which they're basing this on is something that is not unified, supported around the globe, and the methods they're doing it especially.
Yeah, well, again, it remains to be seen to what extent it is authentically opposed. We certainly are hearing a lot, John Idonisi, about how the Saudis and others are now pitching up, not so much the Turks, not so much the Qataris, but others in the Muslim world are beginning to come forward with resources and perhaps even personnel to fight these guys. But I think the real question remains, is there a dime's worth of difference between their ambitions, that of ISIS and the caliphate and so on, and, for example, that of Saudi Arabia? And it's very much, I think the jury is still out. And John, we are almost out. I just have to say thank you very much for your time today and for the really extraordinary service to our country that you have rendered in the past in uniform as a Navy SEAL and now, of course, outside of government, but working with the White Canvas Group. I hope you'll keep coming back to us because, among other things, your insights into how do we wage war against guys like this in domains beyond the obvious military to decisive effect. Thank you, sir. We'll be talking with you soon. Gordon Chang joins us next with an update on Asia, including the Alibaba IPO. Speaking of cyber war, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At America'sMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At americasmightywarriors.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined as we are each week by the man who takes us for a global strategy tour of Asia and does it with great effect, as he does elsewhere, of course, notably at Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com, and very frequently at Fox News, among other outlets. He is, of course, Gordon Chang. Gordon, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, over the past few months, Gordon, you and I have talked from time to time about the initial public offering of a Chinese mega monopoly called Alibaba that is coming to the U.S. market. Talk a little bit about concerns that this IPO may or may not prove the great windfall for investors that it's being touted to be when it's offered, I guess, on Wednesday of this week. But also, Gordon, the very asymmetric treatment that we're allowing Chinese companies like this in our markets when we're not seeing much reciprocity on the part of the Chinese in theirs.
Yes, there's no American company that is listed in China, and there's good reason for that. They have a closed capital market, and they just can't raise that much money, which is the reason why Chinese companies, and it's not just Alibaba, are coming to the United States to list here. Now, Alibaba's IPO is very, very large, could be the largest in U.S. history. This is going to be interesting because Alibaba, I think, is not a good deal from any number of different perspectives. The most important, though, perhaps from the perspective of the investor, is that Alibaba doesn't have the market in the future that people expect it will. And also, the Alibaba share structure is really unusual. It basically divests investors from most of their power. And that's going to be bad because Jack Ma is a real pirate.
Mm. He is the founder and dominant force in that company, of course. And you've pointed out, as have others, Gordon, that the kind of techniques that they're using to maintain control, both in the Cayman Islands and through other mechanisms, are likely really to redound to the detriment of the investor. But it seems as this is going to redound to the detriment of the country more generally if a lot of Americans wind up using this product Alibaba offers. It's a sort of comprehensive soup to nuts information technology shop, among other things, at the detriment of their privacy of information. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, Jack Ma and the Communist Party are as thick as thieves, and clearly when you have a Chinese website and you have foreigners going to it, it opens up all sorts of possibilities. As you also alluded, it is illegal for Alibaba, actually, to take foreign money. And so the ownership interests that Americans and others will be buying are subject to divestment. And this is not just some theoretical problem. The Chinese Supreme Court has ruled that a structure very similar to Alibaba's was illegal under Chinese law. That occurred about a couple of years ago. Plus, also, about a dozen years ago, another Chinese company used a similar structure, and actually the foreign investors were taken out of the company, out of the company by order. And so, essentially, they lost their ownership interest. This is something very similar to Alibaba right now.
Yeah, this is just kind of mind-boggling. I can't imagine that any investor, knowing what you've just said, Gordon, would want to be putting their money into this enterprise. Yet we're certainly hearing, with the help of Goldman Sachs and other big American companies in the financial markets pushing aggressively, that a lot will. I hope they won't rue the day. Gordon, let me turn to another emerging problem, the Russo-Chinese Energy Alliance. What's up with that? And if you would you talk a little bit about what Vladimir Putin is thinking as he not only opens up his country and his markets to the Chinese, but is really, it seems to me, ceding demographic imperatives to the rising presence of China in Russia, again, to the detriment of Russia itself?
Well, there are two very large energy deals between China and Russia. The first one was last October, where Russian state-owned Rosneft entered into a joint venture with China National Petroleum Corporation, basically giving the Chinese an equity stake in a lucrative oil field in eastern Siberia. And that was followed up by a very large gas deal this spring between Gazprom and also CNPC. It appears that Putin is going to offer another equity stake in a very, very good field in eastern Siberia to the Chinese. And essentially, I think he's doing this because the Russian economy right now is in serious trouble. It grew only 1.3% last year, underperforming every estimate. Russian growth rates have now declined for three straight years, indicating not just temporary problems, but structural ones. And so Putin now believes that he needs the Chinese, and so therefore he's no longer resistant to them. He's welcoming them with open arms. And this is not just energy deals. This is going to be sales of frontline fighters and air defense systems.
Yeah, and building a port together in Russia. And again, I'm just struck by the fact that there are an awful lot of Chinese that are now present in Siberia, an otherwise largely unpopulated region with enormous resources. Doesn't Vladimir Putin, I get the imperative that he may feel at the moment, but this does seem short-sighted in the extreme. Is there a kind of Louis XV, après moi le déluge kind of quality to this, that, you know, it's somebody else's problem down the road, I'm just getting mine now and making the deals that I need to try to muddle through? Or is there a larger strategic gambit afoot?
Yeah, it is a little bit of both. I think, though, the more important thing here is that China and Russia are forming the new axis. They see themselves in the same terms. They are, in fact, cooperating. They're very like-minded. They're working together. And this is not just in the Far East. It's also in Syria, Iran, other places. This is going to be a problem for the United States because we have not faced a united China and Russia since the last days of the 1950s. And so essentially, they are working together hand in hand. Now, I agree with you. This is short-sighted in the sense that the Chinese could take back Siberia, which they really believe is theirs. And so right now, Putin is doing some short-term things that could end up long-term detriment for Russia. But nonetheless, in the short term, these two countries can be really, really troublesome to the United States and the rest of the international community.
Yeah, it is interesting because not least the arming of the Chinese combined with these other steps is only creating a more formidable threat, as you say, both for Russia and for the rest of us. Gordon Chang, let me turn to another topic. Speaking of China's future trajectory, there is a report out, I see it in the Sydney Morning Herald, that Merrill Lynch is assessing that China's economic condition, you were talking about Russia's not being so hot, but even China's, despite an awful lot of boosterism behind it, is nonetheless perhaps following the same trajectory as Japan did, which went into a slump and hasn't really pulled out of it for two decades or so.
China would be lucky to have Japan's trajectory after the bursting of the Great Bubble. We have now seen some very, very troubling numbers, official numbers, come out of China for both July and August. You've got the property market, which is starting to turn down, and the property market can take down the rest of the Chinese economy. Now, Japan was a rich country when it had its problems after the Great Bubble burst in the beginning of the 1990s. But China is much poorer, and it's got so many more problems than Japan did at that time. So right now, I think the Chinese economy could end up being one of the big drivers of geopolitical change, and China, which is flailing about, is something that we have to worry about. This is something that you got a weak China, a weak Russia. They're seeing in each other the need to cooperate, and that's why this is a problem. If you had a stronger China and a stronger Russia, they'd be fighting with each other. But now they really do perceive their own weaknesses, so they're cooperating. And that makes them a real threat to us.
Yeah, that axis is the subject of a full day's programming tomorrow. Gordon, we will be talking with author of the subject by the name of Melek Kalin, and I look forward to getting his sense of this and to continue to monitor it closely with you, of course. Gordon, as always, thank you for your time. Keep up the good work and come back to us again very soon. The rest of you, I hope, will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.